أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، بارئ الخلائق أجمعين، باعث الأنبياء والمرسلين، ثم الصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين، سيدنا وحبيب قلوبنا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد. وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين، أما بعد، سلام عليكم جميعا ورحمة الله وبركاته. Last night in our discussion, we spoke about the importance of developing the capacity for justice. And we say that we cannot develop the capacity for justice until we develop the capacity for morality, until we develop ethics, until we develop spirituality, until we develop the ability to reason and rationality, until we develop strong communities. So over the course of the next few nights, inshallah, every night, we'd like to take a look at one of the qualities of a helper of the 12th Imam or the community of the 12th Imam and see how we can develop those qualities within ourselves. The hadith that I want to share with you today is a hadith from the 6th Holy Imam that appears in the book Al-Ghaybah by An-Nu'mani. It is narrated that the 6th Imam, Al-Imam Al-Sadiq alayhi afdal al-salati wassalam, he says, إِذَا خَرَجَ, when the 12th Imam rises, when the 12th Imam starts his revolution, خَرَجَ مِنْ هَذَا الْأَمْرِ مَنْ كَانَ يَرَى أَنَّهُ مِنْ أَهْلِهِ. People who will think that they are going to be amongst the helpers of the 12th Imam, some of them will desert him and they will leave him. وَدَخَلَ فِيهِ شِبْهُ عَبَدَةِ الشَّمْسِ وَالْقَمَرِ. And some of those people who aren't Muslims, who are like the sun and the moon worshippers, will be amongst those who will come to help him and accept him. It's a very thought-provoking hadith. And the question that it begs of us is, what are the qualities of these people who thought they were going to be amongst the helpers of the 12th Imam? And what are these qualities that made them desert the 12th Imam? And what are the characteristics of those people who didn't even know about the 12th Imam, but they are the same characteristics that brought them to the 12th Imam and helped them to accept the message of the 12th Imam? Tonight, I'd like to share one of these qualities with you. One of the qualities of the helpers of the 12th Imam is that they are truth-loving people. They are truth-obedient people. They have a spirit of loving the truth. In Arabic, a person who is obedient to the truth or obedient to the truth itself is called ittiba'ul haqq. And the opposite of it, which is obedience to falsehood, is called ittiba'ul batil. In Surah Muhammad, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala talks about the believers and says, يُكَفِّرْ عَنْهُمْ سَيِّئَاتِهِمْ. The Almighty is going to forgive their mistakes. وَيُصْلِحُ لَهُمْ بَالَهُمْ. And the Almighty is going to reform their condition. In the Arabic language, one of the words for the qalb, one of the words for the heart is bal. When a thought appears to your mind, in Arabic you would say, خَطَرَ بِبَالِي. It came to my heart. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, God is the one who is going to reform their hearts for them. What have they done that the Almighty saw within them a capacity of being reformed? The verse continues, ذَلِكَ بِأَنَّ الَّذِينَ كَفَرُوا اتَّبَعُوا الْبَاطِلَ وَأَنَّ الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا اتَّبَعُوا الْحَقَّ مِنْ رَبِّهِمْ. This is because those who disbelieve, they follow that which is batil. And as for those who believe, they followed that which is the truth, and it is the truth that can be associated to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. One of the qualities of the helpers of the 12th Imam, the most fundamental quality, and the one we will speak about before all other qualities, is obedience to the truth, seeking the truth, loving the truth, wherever we see it, whenever we see it, in whosever hands we see it. You find that one of the causes of stagnation within our own life and within our community occurs when we're not able to follow the truth. You'll notice there are certain debates and certain controversies that have been raging in the Muslim community. And they've been dragging on for years and years, not because the truth is not clear from falsehood, rather because defending a particular dogma, a particular tradition, a particular practice, a particular thought that I've held on to for a very long time has become more important to me than defending the truth. Sometimes we have conflict in the family or conflict in the community. And the conflict continues not because right is not clear from wrong, but to the contrary, because defending my honor, defending my ego, defending my people, defending my group, my subgroup, my party, has become more important to me than defending the truth, than obeying the truth. Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam complained about this on his way to Karbala. There was one place where he was stopped. And when Hura had stopped him twice, qama khatiban, he stood up and addressed. And he addressed his caravan, he addressed his soldiers, and he said to them, ala tarawna, do you not see, anna al-haqqa la yu'malu bih, a time has come when people are no longer obedient to the truth. The truth is not acted upon. وَأَنَّ الْبَاطِلَ لَا يُتَنَاهَا عَنْ, and a time has come when falsehood is not being prevented. لَيَرْغَبُ الْمُؤْمِنْ فِي لِقَاءِ رَبِّهِ, in such a situation, a believer desires to go and meet Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. You find it creates stagnation within our own spiritual growth as well, our own religious and intellectual growth. There are certain topics that we like to hear about because we're applying them in our lives. And there are certain topics that we don't like to hear about because we're struggling with them in our lives. There are certain questions you'll find a time in your own life, in my own life. There are certain questions I will ask about, and there are certain questions I will not ask about because I'm afraid the answer that I get is not going to be to my liking. Sometimes, even when we have to ask a question, the question is a one-liner, the preamble to it is three paragraphs. Trying to massage the answer to elicit a particular response. Sometimes we find within ourselves that the same question will be asked from different speakers, in the hope that one speaker may give the answer that is to my liking. In one of the scholars, he says that somebody wrote to me, and he said, this is the question that I have in mind, and these are the answers that I have received so far. Listen, if your answer is in line with these answers, please write back to me. If your answer is not in line with these answers, please do not write back to me. This happens, the Quran says, when ittiba'ul hawa, following our desires, following our whims, becomes more important to us than ittiba'ul haq, following the truth. My dear brothers, one of the things that we need to do in the preparation of the coming of the 12th Imam and in the preparation of establishing justice within our communities and societies is become people who are truth-loving. truth obedient. Right? When you look at the helpers of Imam al-Hussein, each of them were unconditionally and fervently committed to the truth. Nothing to them was more important than the truth itself. It's very interesting when you read about some of the stories that come to us about Imam al-Hussein on his way towards Kufa and on his way towards Karbala. And some of these narrations in their entirety are only found in the written narration of the tragedy. Normally, we don't hear about them in the oral narration of the tragedy. It's narrated when Imam al-Hussein was traveling towards Kufa, one of those days he fell asleep on his horse. When he woke up, he said, "Inna lillah wa inna ilayhi raji'un." Surely we all come from God and we all belong to God and we shall return to Him. Ali ibn al-Akbar hears his father saying this. So he comes to his father and he says, "Ya abati, O my dear father, lima istarja'ta? Why did you recite the verse of istarja'? Why did you say, Inna lillah wa inna ilayhi raji'un?" Imam al-Hussein says to him, "My dear son, I fell asleep. In my sleep, I saw a dream. In my dream, I saw there were horsemen behind us. They were riding towards us. And they were saying, this caravan is moving forward and death is moving towards them. And I woke up and I realized the interpretation of this dream is that these horsemen are our souls and they are informing us of our imminent death, that we are moving closer to death." The young man, Ali ibn al-Akbar, hears his father telling him that we are moving closer towards death. Look at the first reaction that he gives. He says, "Ya abati, O my dear father, alasna alal haq." Are we not on the haq? Are we not on the truth? As if to say, what else matters as long as we are obedient to the truth and we are following the truth? Imam said, "Yes, my dear son, by the one in whose hands is my life, there is no doubt that we are on the truth." Ali ibn Akbar responds by saying, "Then it matters not whether we meet death or death meets us, for we shall have died on the truth." One of the qualities of the followers of the Ahlul Bayt is that they follow the truth. In fact, even if a person is not amongst the followers of the Ahlul Bayt, but he has a truth-loving spirit, a truth-following spirit, he will find his way to the Ahlul Bayt. Now, how do we develop a truth-obedient spirit? What I'd like to do tonight is to share with you one practical point, and then the rest of the discussion tonight will be a theoretical discussion. So let's begin with the salawat ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. You find that whenever we think about developing certain qualities, especially if they are characteristics that we struggle with, we normally console ourselves by saying that when it really matters, I will manifest this quality. I have it within me. And when it really matters, I will come up with the goods. I just haven't come across a situation where it really matters. I haven't come across a situation where truth is fighting falsehood, where we're trying to establish it at a global level. All my situations have been small situations. I remember speaking to a young man and I say to him that, "Brother, we have been missing you in the masjid and we would like to see you more regularly in the masjid." So this is what the young man said to me. He said to me, "Brother, I'm working on developing my career right now. I'm working on developing my business at this time. But I promise you, when I make the first $1 million, I will build a masjid for you." I say to him, "Brother, if you don't have time for us right now, you're not going to have time for us later either. If we don't have a truth-loving spirit when it comes to small things, we are not going to have a truth-obedient spirit when it comes to big things either. If we want to know whether we have a characteristic within ourselves, a character is a character. A character does not make distinction between big and small, important and not important. A character is something which is second nature to you. If it's second nature to you, whether it is a young man telling you something or the imam of the time telling you something, if you're obedient to the truth, you will accept it now, you'll accept it then. One of the reasons we struggle with the truth normally is because the truth threatens some of our interests. We're attached to something. We love something. We're really associated to something. And we come to realize that accepting the truth and obeying the truth has become a threat to that thing which I love. It's become a threat to my attachment. So what we realize from this is that the same attachment that prevents me from being truth obedient in this situation is the same attachment that's going to prevent me from being truth obedient when the imam comes as well. It's a very peculiar story that emerges just before Imam al-Hussein reaches Kufa. And again, this is one of those narrations that you will find in the written tradition, seldom in the oral recitation. This man is coming out of the city of Kufa, and Imam al-Hussein is now nearing the city of Kufa. It so happens on that day, they camp in the same area. So as it was with Zuhair ibn al-Qayn, Imam al-Hussein sent a messenger to go into his tent and say, tell him that Hussein, the son of Ali, is inviting you to come into his tent. The man receives the messenger of Imam al-Hussein and says, I have a message for him. Tell him that I do not wish to meet with him. If I wanted to meet with him, I would have stayed in Kufa. The reason why I left the city of Kufa is because I want to avoid meeting him. So the messenger comes back and conveys the message of this man. The narrator says, Al-Hussein himself stood up, came out of his tent, and went into the other person's tent. You know, if somebody hasn't said salamun alaykum to you, you go say salamun alaykum to him. If somebody hasn't called you, you go and call him. If somebody hasn't shown love and affection to you, you go and show love and affection to him. So Imam al-Hussein sits down with that person and explains his mission to him and says, this is what we're trying to achieve. Now listen to the answer of this man. The man says to Imam al-Hussein, I know in my heart that the one who follows you is going to be successful and he will enter Jannah. And the one who rejects you is never going to be successful. But I also tell you that I love my life too much and I can't see myself sacrificing my life for you. The man continues. He says, but I have a horse. And my horse has always helped me to escape in a difficult situation. And whenever I wanted to escape, this horse has helped me to escape. Though I can't give my life to you, I am willing to give my horse to you. Imam al-Hussein responded to him, and you can look in the oral, on the written narrations to listen to the response of Imam al-Hussein. But those attachments, this man was attached to the life of this world. Those attachments that prevent us from being truth-loving and truth-obedient in small issues are the same attachments that are going to prevent us when the 12th Imam comes. When it really matters, as you would say. Right? So we have to start being truth-obedient in our day-to-day lives. Within our families, within our decision-making, within our conversations, within our community work, within our debates, within our arguments. If I'm having a debate with somebody, in the course of the debate, I come to realize the man, even though he's younger than me, even though he's not as educated as I am, what he says is the truth, and what I'm saying is wrong, I don't make excuses. I say you're right, and I'm wrong. If in my relationship with somebody, I've been wronging them, and for years I have made an excuse for why I'm allowed to wrong them, and today I come to realize those excuses were not valid, a truth-obedient person would go up and acquiesce to his mistake. Sometimes we find it even difficult being truthful to ourselves. Today, one of the struggles that many health practitioners and mental health providers struggle with is something called denial, where a person who's struggling with substance abuse, struggling with mental health, struggling with self-image, struggling with health, for example, struggling with many different aspects of their lives, have a difficulty admitting that to themselves. And I wonder sometimes if we were raised to be truth-obedient people, truth-loving people, a truth-loving community, would we have the same struggle with denial as we have today? Right? So one of the qualities of the helpers of the 12th Imam is that whenever they see the truth, even if it is sour for them, even if it means they have to step on their own ego, they have to step on their own words, they're willing to do that. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala promises, وَيُصْلِحُ لَهُمْ بَالَهُمْ. God is the one who's going to raise them. God is the one who's going to reform their situation for them. The first step in our spiritual growth is to become a truth-obedient person. If we're not able to be truth-obedient, our spiritual growth is not going to be a lot. One of the scholars that some of you would have heard about is a scholar by the name of Sheikh Ayatollah Jawad Maliki Tabrizi. Some of you have read books by him, Liqa'ullah, Meeting Allah Subhanahu Wa Ta'ala, Al-Muraqibat, The Observations of the Various Months of the Calendar. He talks about the onset of his spiritual journey. And he says, at the onset of my spiritual journey, I had struggled for almost 2 years without any results. So finally I went to a spiritual teacher, I believe it was Mullah Hussein Quli Hamadani. And I say to him, I've been struggling for 2 years and I don't see any spiritual results. So he asked me, who are you? And I said, I'm so-and-so from Tabriz. He said, you're from so-and-so family. I said, yes, but those people, they're not part of. It turned out that within their family, they had a disagreement. There were some conflicts between factions of the family. So I started to distance myself from that part of the family. He said to me, the day you're able to take their shoes and put them together and put them properly and put them in the shelf is the day you're going to make spiritual progress. And he had a choice to make that night. Was he going to be obedient to the truth when he recognized it? Or was he going to be stubborn to the truth? Was he going to be in denial and say, no, I've not been doing anything wrong? The next morning he was seen. When people were inside the majlis, he was outside taking their shoes and putting them in the shelves. News of this reached their family in Tabriz. The family decided to resolve their conflicts as well. He says, that is the day when I started seeing results in my spiritual progress. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. From this point forward, our conversation is going to be a purely theoretical discussion. And I'll ask for your attention. I know it's been a long day for some of you, but nonetheless, I pray Imam al-Hussein aids and helps us in this journey for understanding the truth and recognizing it and accepting it. Ameen. Today we say that we live in modern societies. And there was a time we used to live in a traditional society. And we talk about the differences between modernity and traditional societies. For many of us, when we think of a modern society, we think of an industrialized society. When we think of a traditional society, we think of an agrarian society, a farming society. When you think of modernity, you think of technology, you think of resources, you think of cities. When you think of traditional societies, you think of a lack of technology, a more natural lifestyle. However, when we're talking about modernity and traditionalism, we're not talking about technology and the lack of technology, industrialization or the lack of industrialization. When we talk about modernity, we're talking about the approach of the modern man, and how is the approach and the mindset of the modern man different from the approach of the traditional man. So very important to make this distinction. You find there are fundamental differences in our approach. In traditional society, we had a sense of ta'abbud. We accepted authority. We accepted what others told us, even if we didn't always understand it. This was built into the traditional man, right? A simple example for you, you go in a traditional society, you say music is haram. Why is music haram? Because قال الإمام الصادق عليه السلام, this is the hadith, the traditional man accepts it. You come to modern society, we're no longer accepting of blind authority. We want to reason. We want to think. We want to intellect. We want to understand it for ourselves. So you go to a modern society and you say, music is haram. Why is music haram? Well, there you have to say, because these are the consequences of listening to music. The approach is very different. Go to a traditional society, the mindset was collectivistic. The collective is far more important than the individual. Come to a modern society, it is individualistic. The individual and the integrity of the individual is more important than the integrity of the collective sometimes. I mean, think about it. When we lived in traditional societies, the focus was on responsibilities. What are my duties towards others? What are the responsibilities I have towards them? One of the documents that we have in history is a document called Risalat al-Huquq, the Treaties of Rights. And even though it's called the Treaties of Rights, if you look into it, it's a treaties of duties and responsibilities. This is your neighbor, what is your duty towards him, and what is the right that he has over you? The modern man doesn't think like that. His approach and his mindset is very different. He doesn't talk about duties and responsibilities, he talks about rights. What are my rights? What are the duties that others have towards me? So there's a very distinct difference between a traditional society and a modern society, and doesn't have much to do with technology or much to do with industrialization. It has something to do with it, though. Now, when I started this conversation, I wasn't entirely accurate with you. Well, we don't live in a modern society. We live in what is called a postmodern society, a society that comes after modernity. It's very important to understand the differences philosophically between a postmodern society and a modern society and a traditional society. Now that's what we want to get into tonight. Now I want to share with you one of those differences. So in a traditional society, there was a concept of truth, haqq, and the concept of batil. And you came to understand the truth from two sources. From the aql, from the intellect, and from the naql, from divine revelation, correct? The traditional man understood that there are certain things that the human intellect can understand, and there are certain things which the human intellect is not able to understand. How do you know God exists? The intellect is able to understand that. How do you know there's a hereafter? The intellect is able to understand that. What does the hereafter look like? What does barzakh look like? What does the day of judgment look like? The traditional man understood, the intellect is not capable of understanding that. He relied on divine revelation. And then came the era of enlightenment, the 16th, 17th century. And it ushered in modernity. And modern man in general did away with revelation, did away with the authority of the prophets, and said everything must be rationalized. Everything must be understood. Everything must be empirically demonstrated. Everything must be observed. If it can be observed, it exists, and if it can't be observed, then... Even as a Muslim community, we went through that phase, didn't we? If you remember in the 70s and the 80s, everything had to be scientifically proven. Can you prove God scientifically? Because we need to be able to rationalize it, and we can rationalize it. Can you prove the day of judgment and the hereafter scientifically? Can you look at near-death experiences and demonstrate that? Can you prove a miracle scientifically? If that can be proven scientifically, then it's not a miracle, is it? The Quran and science. And every verse of the Quran, whether it was speaking to that or it wasn't speaking to that, we tried to interpret it scientifically. And then came postmodernity. What's the difference in postmodernity? Let's try to understand the difference first, and we'll see the impact it has on our culture. In postmodernity, it did away with the concept of truth and falsehood altogether. There is no objective truth, and there is no objective falsehood. What is truth subjective to you. What is falsehood subjective to you. When you talk about a proof for the truth or you talk about evidence for the truth, that is not a proof, that is not an evidence. It's your narrative for the truth. Inasmuch as that narrative is authentic to you, that is the truth to you, and I will respect that. And as much as it is not authentic to you, that is not the truth for you. In simple words, truth became like beauty. When you say beauty is in the eye of the beholder, the postmodernists somewhat say that truth is in the eye of the beholder. Okay? It's a very distinct difference between postmodernity and even modernity, let alone traditional society. Now you have the right to ask speaker on the pulpit, what difference does that have to our lives? How is that relevant to our lives? These are philosophical discussions that they have in the universities and in the academia. Does it make any difference to the way we live in our communities? And it does. We should never make the assumption that these conversations that happen, no matter how subconscious they are, that happen within our societies, that we as a community or a faith community are immune from it. We're never immune from it. Right? In fact, we're influenced by it more than we're influenced by the behavior that happens in our society. Why? Because behavior is something you can see and you can protect yourself and your children from it. Thought, especially subconscious thought, is something you cannot see. Let me ask you, for many of you who have children, you monitor your children when they are online, don't you? What are they watching? What movie are they watching? So let me ask you, what do you monitor? See, I monitor that the behavior in the movies is not contrary to the teachings of Islam. What do we monitor? We monitor the violence. We monitor inappropriate images. We monitor inappropriate language. Yes? Yeah. Let me ask you, do you monitor thought? Is there a filter for thought? Do you have a filter in your computer for thought? Thought that is coming into the minds of our children. So we're not immune to the thinking that's happening in our society. Now, I want to share with you some examples. And this thinking, postmodernist thought, has affected our media and journalism, has affected our educational philosophies, has affected our communities, and affected our culture as well. Before I share examples with you, though, I want to make one thing very clear. I'm sharing these examples as an observation. It is not a critique of anything that I'm about to say. Whether it is right what we're doing or wrong, whether a part of it is right or a part of it is wrong, I am not looking at that at all. I'm just sharing observations with you. When you look at the media, nowadays they will tell you, if it wasn't clear before, that we live in a post-truth society, where objective facts are no longer important. Objective facts are no longer relevant. You simply have to be able to appeal to a person's emotions and appeal to their prejudices to be effective. Nobody understands that better than Donald Trump. That we live in a post-truth society. Our educational philosophies have changed as well. Again, I'm just making observations. I'm not critiquing anything. You find that a student-centered approach has become very vogue in our educational philosophies. A student-centered approach is a product of postmodernist educational philosophy. We won't go into that tonight. It also affects our faith and the way we think about our religion. Okay? You find that there was a period of time where being on the truth was important. And being on the truth was the most important thing. Today, when people come and speak to you about your faith, it is not as relevant to them as whether you are on the truth or not, as it is to them whether you're doing the right thing or not. Let me explain. I was speaking to somebody recently and they said, "Tell me about your faith." Normally, when somebody asks you about your faith, you start to explain the usul of the deen. And maybe I was doing that, and this person said to me, "I don't want to know the dogma of your religion. Tell me, what does your religion mean to you? What difference does it make to you? What difference does it make to your life?" That's what I want to know. Today, you find people don't judge you by what your beliefs are. They judge you by what your actions are, more than your beliefs. There's a pastor in Houston area. His name is Joel Osteen. And he runs a mega church. It's a church that on every Sunday morning will hold tens of thousands of worshipers. It's huge. Many of our communities can only dream of having a prayer space like that. There was a flood in Houston, and all the schools and all the community centers opened their doors so that people who don't have shelter can come and stay there. Joel Osteen didn't do that. He closed his mega church. And it didn't matter to people. They gave him a lot of flack for it, but it didn't matter to them whether he's speaking the truth or he's not speaking the truth, where he's on the right or he's not on the right, what are his beliefs. The only question they asked is, if he is on the truth, then how come his actions don't show it? Okay? We need to be cognizant of that as well. We can go outside in the community and talk about how great Imam al-Hussein is, but remember one thing, you live in a postmodernist society. Truth and falsehood don't have the same value they used to have. You can go and plaster his name all over the city, and this is what Al-Hussein stood for. And the person coming up to you will ask you only one question. He will say, "If this is what Al-Hussein stood for, you tell me, how often do you open your center and your mosque in the winter to give shelter to people who don't have a shelter? To give a home to people who don't have a home? To give a warm bowl of soup to those who have nothing to eat? Don't tell me about truth or falsehood. you live in a postmodernist society. You look within our own community. Those of you who have gray hair like myself, we remember a time when debates were quite important within the Muslim community. We looked forward to debates in the 70s and the 80s because the assumption there was that there is truth and there is falsehood, and through debating, we want to prove the truth. So you remember, Muslims debated against atheists, and every library had a cassette of Haj Hasnain Rajab Ali debating an atheist, yes? Muslims debated against non-Muslims. And famously in the 80s and 90s, we used to watch the debates of Ahmed Didat, if you remember. Yes? Okay. And Muslims or Shias debated the Ahl Sunnah. Nowadays, it's not that we don't debate, but you would agree with me that debating is not the in thing anymore. We've turned from debate to dialogue, correct? And for good reason sometimes. We recognize the divisive nature of debates. We recognize if debates don't happen in a healthy and respectful environment, it can lead to division, it can lead to conflict, it can lead to violence. That has an influence. But I think partly the reason we've shifted from dialogue or from debate to dialogue is because we are also influenced by postmodernist thought. There was a period of time when the tabligh boards in every community were very active. And again, I'm just observing, I'm not critiquing or commenting. We're very active in converting people towards the truth because the concept of truth was very important. Today we have tabligh boards. But the role of the tabligh boards is simply to raise awareness in the society so that, for example, we don't face Islamophobia. So that people are aware of what we believe as Muslims. Running out of time this evening, I'm going to end with a couple of comments and inshallah we'll continue with the conversation tomorrow evening if we recite the salawat ala Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad. When we come to the Qur'an, you find that the concept of truth and falsehood is very important to the Qur'an and very integral to the Qur'an. The Qur'an asserts there is an objective truth, there is something that you can objectively understand to be false. Two, human beings have the ability to understand the truth and they have the ability to distinguish it from falsehood. This doesn't mean that every human being will understand the whole truth, but a human being can understand some of the truth. Three, following the truth is very important because the truth has real consequences. The truth has long-term consequences. The truth has real difference that it makes. The truth is strong, and falsehood is not the same. So let me end with a verse from the Quran. This verse talks about why you should believe in Islam and why you should believe in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Sometimes we'll often ask, what is the benefit of believing in Islam? What are the benefits of believing in Islam in the dunya and the akhirah? So look at the argument in this verse of the Quran. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, ذَلِكَ, you should believe. You should accept this. ذَلِكَ بِأَنَّ اللَّهَ هُوَ الْحَقُّ وَأَنَّ مَا يَدْعُونَ مِن دُونِهِ الْبَاطِلُ. You should accept God because God is the Haqq, and that which they worship besides Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, that is batil. Even before you speak of benefits, you have a duty, an ethical duty, to be committed to the truth, to accept the truth, and to be obedient towards the truth. Inshallah, we'll continue the conversation tomorrow evening. On this night, let us take our hearts to Karbala. As Imam al-Hussein entered the land of Karbala on the second day of Muharram. And let us take our hearts there by doing tawassul to Aba Abdullah and join me in reciting the tawassul to him. Ya Aba Abdullah, Ya Hussein ibn Ali, أيها الشهيد يا ابن رسول الله يا حجة الله على خلقه يا سيدنا ومولانا إنا توجهنا واستشفعنا وتوسلنا بك إلى الله وقدمناك بين يدي حاجاتنا يا وجيها عند الله اشفع لنا. One more time. يا وجيها عند الله اشفع لنا. Imam al-Hussein was anticipating his martyrdom. He always knew that he would be martyred towards the end of his life. It is narrated towards the end of Imam al-Hassan's life, Imam al-Hussein was sitting next to him and tears were flowing from his eyes. And Imam al-Hassan said to him, "My dear brother, why do I see you crying?" And Imam al-Hussein said to him, "How can I not cry when I see what the people have done to you? When I see you in this particular state?" When al-Hassan alayhi salam heard this, he said to Imam al-Hussein, "La yawmun ka yawmika ya Aba Abdillah." There is no day like your day, O al-Hussein. 30,000 people will gather, all calling themselves Muslims, and they will want to shed your blood, and they will want to take your women and daughters as captives. Imam al-Hussein was aware that he would be martyred. As he was leaving the city of Mecca, Muhammad ibn al-Hanafiya said to him, "O Hussein, if you must leave the city of Mecca, then do not go to the city of Kufa. Go to Yemen, go to lands far away, but do not go to the city of Kufa." The next day he saw Imam al-Hussein with his women and children leaving the city of Mecca, going towards the city of Kufa. He said to him, "O Hussein, did you not hear what I said to you yesterday?" And Imam al-Hussein in this narration said to him, "I heard, but last night I saw Rasulullah in my dream. The Prophet of Allah said to me, O Hussein, إِنَّ اللَّهَ قَدْ شَاءَ أَن يَرَاكَ قَتِيلًا." God has willed that you be martyred, O Hussein. So Muhammad ibn al-Hanafiya said to him, "Then if you must be martyred, then why do you take your women? Why do you take your children on this difficult journey?" He said, "I heard the Prophet of Allah saying, إِنَّ اللَّهَ قَدْ شَاءَ أَن يَرَاهُنَّ سَبَايَا." God has willed that they be for the sake of Islam, be held captive and taken prisoners. Imam al-Hussein left the city of Mecca and went towards the city of Kufa. It was on the second day of Muharram that the caravan of Imam al-Hussein was forced to stop on a particular piece of land. Imam al-Hussein asked the people, "What is the name of this land?" Some of them said, "It is called Nainawa." He said, "Does this land have another name?" Some of them said, "It is called Ghadiriyya." He asked, "Does this land have another name?" Somebody said to him, "O Hussein, this land is also known as Karbala." He said, "Indeed, this is the land of Karbin wa Bala." He said to his companions, "This is the land of hardship and calamities. Descend upon this land. This is where we're going to pitch our tents. And this is where our blood is going to be shed. And this is where our graves are going to be made." And that was the second day of Muharram. It is narrated as al-Hussein was traveling towards the city of Kufa. On the way to the city of Kufa, a messenger came to him and informed him of the martyrdom of Muslim ibn Aqil. Al-Hussein said, "Rahim Allahu Muslima," may Allah have mercy upon Muslim. And then the narrator says he called for the daughter of a Muslim. And he called for his daughter and made her sit on his laps. and he showed a lot of love to the daughter of Muslim. He showed a lot of affection to the daughter of Muslim. He put his hands on her head, and those who were around him, they understood that the daughter of Muslim has now become an orphan. I will say, oh Hussein, when she became an orphan, you showed so much love and affection to her. But there will come a time on the day of Ashura when your horse will return back to the camp, and your Sakina will be looking at that horse, and she will say, horse of my father, O Zuljana of my father, I know what has happened to my father. I can see the blood dripping on your body, but tell me one thing, when my father went to the battlefield, he was very thirsty. Did they kill him thirsty? Or did they give him any water? وسيعلم الذين ظلموا آل محمد أي منقلب ينقلبون إنا لله وإنا إليه راجعون مات حسين.